This is Kathy coming to you with the pantograph for Tuesday, the 23rd of December. Starting with the front page, Missed Signs, Deadly Outcomes. This is a public service journalism report. Raina Schmidt remembers her daughter, Alyssa Lindhorst, as having a creative soul with a special place in her heart for animals. Lindhorst loved every type of art, from painting to poetry. The 28-year-old died on February 24, 2020, just 4 days after she was booked into Illinois' Madison County Jail on an outstanding warrant for unlawful possession of a controlled substance. Lindhorst's death was brought on by opioid withdrawal symptoms going ignored and untreated by the jail medical staff, according to court records from a civil suit filed by Schmidt in 2022. "They just don't treat them like they would if someone was having a heart condition," said Schmidt. "They just act like they deserve it. They don't view them as people." Lindhorst's story is one example of how substance withdrawal while in custody can sometimes escalate to severe medical emergencies. Illinois sheriffs and jail staff interviewed for this series said managing opioid and alcohol withdrawal is one of the biggest challenges. Symptoms could include nausea, insomnia, anxiety, increased body temperature, racing heart, muscle and bone pain, sweating, chills, and high blood pressure. In some cases, withdrawal can be fatal for individuals with pre-existing medical conditions. The autopsy of Gerard Taylor, who died while in custody of the Tazewell County Jail in 2017, showed that he had succumbed to a heart condition related to alcohol and drug use that was exacerbated by dehydration. Prior to that, Taylor had suffered from profuse sweating, extreme chest pains, and hallucinations during a 4-day withdrawal period. According to a report released last year by the Prison Policy Institute, approximately 8% of the people met the criteria for substance abuse use disorders in 2019 nationally. But substance abuse disorders are far more common among people who are arrested. It's at 41%. The study also states that of the nearly 3,000 local jails nationwide at that time, 63% screened people for opioid disorder when they were admitted, and only half provided medications for people experiencing withdrawal. An even smaller percentage of jails, 41%, provided behavioral or psychological treatment, and 29% provided education about overdose, the study states. For offenders experiencing drug, alcohol, and mental health problems, Sangamon County Jail Superintendent Larry Beck said the jail is a revolving door. "A lot of the inmates frequent our jail. We know who they are, and we already know their medical and mental health history," Beck said. "We have inmates that come back through our door that are on drugs, alcohol, and suffering from mental illness." Coles County Sheriff Kent Martin added that opioid and mental health crises worked in tandem, creating a snowball. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, more than one in four adults living with serious mental health problems also have a substance abuse problem. This occurs more frequently for individuals suffering from depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, or personality disorders. "The individuals that have been using drugs their entire life, it's taken a number on their mental capacity," Martin said. "A lot of them can't care for themselves, and they have a lot of health issues stemming from that as well." The Illinois Criminal Justice Authority conducted a 2018 survey in which they asked the Illinois Sheriff's Association to survey jails across the state with the list of questions regarding opioids and inmates. About 39% of the state's jails responded to the survey, which included counties from jurisdictions with relatively high opioid overdose death rates. Those counties represented in the survey accounted for 71% of overdose deaths in 2017, according to the Illinois Department of Public Health. That same study estimated that 63% of sentenced jail inmates meet the criteria for having substance use disorders, compared to 9% in the general population. Identifying substance use disorders. Lindhorst was appearing in court on February 20, 2020 in Granite City, Illinois, when the judge realized she had an outstanding warrant in Hartford. According to the lawsuit, deputies arrested Lindhorst and took her to the Madison County Jail, where she told the staff she was suffering from opioid withdrawal. According to the deputies on site, a medical form was filled out describing Lindhorst's symptoms, but such a note was never found on her file. It is unclear if she received a medical evaluation. Medical and behavioral health assessments are required in Illinois when inmates are booked. Although the line of questioning can vary from county to county, many assessments include questions about whether an individual is currently or at risk of detoxing and whether there are complications an individual experiences when they do detox. Schmidt said jail nurses and other medical staff interviewed at the time claimed they were unaware of Lindhorst's condition despite her having told them she was suffering from withdrawal. They all basically said, "We had no idea she was even here. No one ever told us," said Schmidt. They're claiming the first time they knew something was wrong was that morning when one of the guards saw the nurse come in for the morning shift and said, "Hey, I want you to come check on this girl here." And they're claiming that was the first information they got that she was even in the facility. Lindhorst's symptoms became more severe over the next 3 days. Fellow inmates completed a sick slip for Lindhorst, but one of the jail staff members threw it in the garbage where it was later found, according to the lawsuit. Correctional officers witnessed Lindhorst lying by the toilet in her cell, covered in vomit, and made no effort to seek medical attention, according to the lawsuit. Madison County Jail Administrator declined to comment for this story. It wasn't until breakfast the next morning that Lindhorst finally received medical attention after inmates began yelling that she had stopped breathing. Lindhorst was then carried from her cell into the main hallway where staff began forming CPR. She was declared dead at 8:30 a.m. The Madison County Board in 2023 agreed to pay $3 million to settle Schmidt's case, which also required updated opioid withdrawal training for Madison County jail staff. Under the Illinois Administrative Code, at least one staff member of every shift must complete and receive biannual recertification from a recognized course of first aid that includes CPR. Correctional officers are also subject to annual mental health and suicide prevention training. Although staff may receive this training through partnerships with healthcare contractors or other providers, they are responsible for identifying withdrawal symptoms as a medical risk. Treatment options. According to the Prison Policy Institute report, the most effective treatment of substance use disorder, medication-assisted treatment, or MAT, is the least commonly provided. About 24% of the jails continue MAT for people already engaged in treatment, while only 19% initiate MAT for those who are not, the study states. Currently, there are 3 FDA-approved medications used in the treatment of opioid use disorder, including methadone. This helps to normalize brain chemistry, block the euphoric effects of opioids, and relieve cravings, according to the Illinois Department of Public Health. MAT, which is also known as medication-assisted recovery, uses a regimen of one of these medications in combination with behavioral therapy, psychosocial support, and other services. More Illinois jails have added the program to their treatment options. According to 2023 and 24 Illinois Department of Corrections inspection reports, multiple Illinois jails have added MAT programs to their treatment options within the last 2 years. Alex Galp, spokesman for Governor J.B. Pritzker, said the counties have the opportunity to join the Illinois Learning Collaborative to support medication-assisted recovery for justice-involved populations in county jails. This program, which has been in effect since 2021, offers training and technical assistance to its participants to either begin MAT within jails or expand existing programs. Since its inception, 26 counties representing 57% of the state's population outside of Cook County have participated. However, jails don't always have the resources or participants to keep substance abuse programs going. Former Woodford County Jail Superintendent Dennis Wirtz said the jail had offered a MAT program for a few years with in-house counseling. However, there weren't enough inmates taking advantage of the program, so the counselors left. "We do give each inmate a list of medical and mental health providers in our area upon each release if they wish to seek treatment outside of the facility," Wirtz said. "They may also take part in the Gateway MAT program in Bloomington, even though they no longer have in-house representation at our facility." MAT is not the only program that has been endangered by a lack of staffing. In Macon County, inmates have utilized the Restore program, which was implemented to help people with alcohol or drug addictions, according to Marion County Lieutenant Jamie Belcher. The 30 hours per week program covers life skills, applying for jobs, and assistance with reading, writing, and arithmetic. Belcher said the program was on hold after a healthcare provider was unable to find a qualified person to help run the program. But in July 2024, the jail acquired a full-time facilitator. Some jails rely on volunteers to run substance abuse programs, which also presents a challenge. DeKalb County Jail Administrator Aaron McRoberts said that because of the difficulty finding volunteers with experience in successful recovery, she doesn't recall the jail ever offering Narcotics Anonymous or similar programs. "I live 30 minutes south of the jail, and if I had to have substance abuse counseling of some sort, I would get it until I got to the DeKalb or Sycamore area, and I've got a significant enough problem and don't have a driver's license. Then what? McRoberts asked. So to me, that continuation here and the access to that continuation would be very beneficial. We cannot arrest our way out. Under the Illinois Substance Abuse Use Disorder Act, which went into effect in 2019, a judge has a discretion to sentence an individual believed to be suffering from a substance use disorder to probation, so long as that individual can be accepted into a designated treatment program. Rebecca Levine, Vice President of Policy for Treatment Alternatives for Safer Communities, said the nonprofit has spent the last 50 years ensuring individuals and families affected by substance use and mental health conditions are diverted to resources outside the justice system. For an individual charged with a crime related to substance abuse, such as illegal drug possession, a judge can impose a sentence that would connect them to a treatment program. Levin said that TASC can offer specialized case management to get people connected to the right resources. No matter how well we do in staffing these facilities, or no matter what the equality of the clinical care is, it's still not the ideal environment for folks to heal, Levin said. It's really asking the question of how do we keep folks out of the facilities in the first place. On March 21st, Governor Pritzker announced the launch of the statewide overdose action plan, the state's collective call to action. The opioid crisis affects everyone in some way. Its victims are of all ages, races, and walks of life. The causes of the epidemic are complex, and the state government must work with everyone, healthcare providers, local agencies, law enforcement, community groups, individual citizens, and national partners toward a solution. As part of the plan, Illinois Department of Human Services Division of Substance Use Prevention and Recovery, or SUPER, is partnering with Treatment Alternatives for Safer Communities, the Illinois State Police, and the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority to expand a deflection initiative that would divert individuals with substance use disorder away from the criminal justice system and into community-based treatment, housing, and social services. We cannot arrest our way out of the overdose crisis, authors of the plan wrote. Supporting the needs of this at-risk population is critical to reducing overdose deaths. But overall funding in the state's fiscal 2025 budget for SUPER decreased by $45 million. Judd DeLoss, Chief Executive Officer of the Illinois Association of Behavioral Health, said a great deal of funding came out of SUPER contracts used to provide funding for substance use services outside of Medicaid. Each year, SUPER enters into contracts using grant funding for behavioral health services to individuals or for services not covered by Medicaid or commercial insurance. If a provider cannot bill Medicaid, they can bill a SUPER contract for services at a rate established by the state. But by February, the law said that SUPER contract funding for the 2025 fiscal year ran dry. The Illinois Opioid Remediation Advisory Board authorized an additional $8 million to close the fiscal 2025 shortfall. The proposed fiscal 2026 funding for SUPER has been increased over the 2025 amounts, but we are unsure if that increase will cover the current demand, DeLoss said. Summer Griffith, Public Information Officer for IDHS, said any overutilization by organizations beyond the amount budgeted per organization may or may not be covered. However, SUPER is committed to reallocating funds for organizations that are underutilized throughout the year. The state attempted to reallocate funding from existing contracts that weren't fully utilized to contracts that exceeded their spending limit. However, DeLaw said the Illinois Opioid Remediation Advisory Board agreed in April to use $8 million in opioid settlement funds to cover fiscal 2025 shortfalls. Last year, the state passed legislation increasing the reimbursement rate for residential treatment and detox services 30% over the previous year. However, the state's budget implementation plan for this current fiscal year removed language guaranteeing a 5% automatic rate increase for residential treatment and detox services and a corresponding increase to the amount available for SUPER contracts to ensure services remain at the same level. The rate reduced to 2% and the contract increase was deleted from revised legislation. It was not a good year for SUD services, DeLoss said. Mental health funding remained at about level. Gauss said the appropriations were adjusted to reflect where program spending has occurred. He added that adjusted appropriations would not impact the progress of the statewide overdose action plan. Medical workers, jail staff, lawmakers, and loved ones of those who died in jail all agreed that there needs to be other options to assist those suffering with substance addictions. Jail isn't the place for an addict, Schmidt said. They aren't getting any help. They're just biding their time. Contact Annalisa Trofimuk at 219-933-3211 if you have more information. Rebecca Levin is the Vice President of Policy for Treatment Alternatives for Safer Communities. This article headline, Trump pauses five wind projects, sites off the East Coast called a security threat. The Trump administration said Monday it paused leases for five large-scale offshore wind projects under construction along the East Coast due to what it said were national security risks identified by the Pentagon. The pause, effective immediately, is the latest step the administration took to hobble offshore wind in its push against renewable energy sources. It comes 2 weeks after a federal judge struck down President Donald Trump's executive order blocking wind energy projects, calling it unlawful. The administration said the pause will give the Interior Department, which oversees offshore wind, time to work with the Defense Department and other agencies to assess the possible ways to mitigate any security risks posed by the projects. The prime duty of the United States government is to protect the American people, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum said in a statement. Today's action addresses emerging national security risks, including the rapid evolution of the relevant adversary technologies and the vulnerabilities created by large-scale offshore wind projects with proximity near our East Coast population centers. The statement did not detail the national security risks. Wind proponents slammed the move, saying it was another blow by the administration against clean energy. The administration said that leases are paused for the Vineyard Wind Project under construction in Massachusetts, the Revolution Wind in Rhode Island and Connecticut, Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind, and two projects in New York, Sunrise Wind and Empire Wind. The Interior Department said unclassified reports from the U.S. government long found that the movement of massive turbine blades and the highly reflective towers create radar interference called clutter. The clutter caused by offshore wind projects obscures legitimate moving targets and generates false targets in the vicinity of the wind projects, the Interior Department said. National security expert and former commander of the USS Cole Kirk Leopold said the projects were awarded permits following years of review by state and federal agencies, including the Coast Guard, the Naval Undersea Warfare Center, the Air Force, and more. The record of decisions all showed that the Department of Defense was consulted at every stage of the permitting process, he said, arguing that the projects would benefit national security because they would diversify the country's energy supply. The action comes 2 weeks after a federal judge struck down Trump's executive order blocking wind energy projects, saying the effort to halt virtually all leasing of wind farms on federal lands and waters was arbitrary and capricious and violates U.S. law. Saris ruled in favor of a coalition of state attorneys general from 17 states in Washington, D.C., led by New York Attorney General Letitia James, that challenged Trump's day one order that paused leasing and permitting for wind energy projects. Trump is hostile to renewable energy, particularly offshore wind, and prioritizes fossil fuels to produce electricity. Wind supporters called the administration actions illegal and said offshore wind provides some of the most affordable, reliable electric power to the grid. For nearly a year, the Trump administration has recklessly obstructed the build-out of clean, affordable power for millions of Americans, just as the country's need for electricity is surging, said Ted Kelly of the Environmental Defense Fund. Now the administration is again illegally blocking clean, affordable energy, Kelly said. We should not be kneecapping America's largest source of renewable power, especially when we need more cheap, homegrown electricity. The administration's actions are especially egregious because at the same time it is propping up aging, expensive coal plants that barely work and pollute our air, Kelly said. The Conservation Law Foundation, a Boston-based environmental group, called the pause a desperate rerun of the Trump administration's failed attempt to kill offshore wind, noting that courts already rejected the administration's arguments. Trying again to halt these projects tramples on the rule of law, threatens jobs, and deliberately sabotages a critical industry that strengthens, not weakens, the Americans' energy security, said Kate Sinding Daly, Senior Vice President for Law and Policy at the Law Foundation. And a holiday-themed article on page one. Would Home Alone 2 fly now? Better security makes films travel chaos less plausible, experts say, by Ryo Yamat. Panic erupts in the McAllister household as soon as the day begins. The parents' alarm clock never rings, bags and coats spill across the floor, and the family barrels out the door to catch a flight to Florida. The pandemonium intensifies at the airport. There, the McAllisters must dodge fellow holiday travelers and luggage as they sprint to their gate while final boarding calls echo overhead. Amid the mayhem, 10-year-old Kevin accidentally boards the wrong plane and finds himself alone in New York City just days before Christmas. More than 30 years after Home Alone turned travel chaos into comedy, the frantic opening scenes of the movie's 1992 sequel still hit close to home, especially as the busy year-end travel period gets underway. But would Kevin McAllister still end up lost in New York in 2025? In an age of federal airport security checkpoints and digitized air travel, the fictional character played by Macaulay Culkin almost certainly wouldn't have gotten into a commercial airline by himself, said Sheldon Jacobson, who studies air travel operations and security and whose research contributed to the design of the TSA PreCheck. In the 1990s, it was plausible, Sheldon said. It was close enough to plausible that people weren't rolling their eyes at it, but this would not happen today. Mix-ups are less feasible. The September 11, 2001 attacks fundamentally changed how Americans move through airports, ushering the creation of the Transportation Security Administration, government-run security screenings, mandatory ID checks, and restricted gate access. Before 9/11, travelers could head straight to their plane with little more than a paper ticket. Now, every passenger and bag is screened, names are checked against flight manifests, and access beyond security checkpoints is tightly controlled. Even the paper tickets that made Kevin's mix-up possible are largely a thing of the past. In the film, Kevin frantically trails a man wearing a coat just like his father's to the wrong gate at Chicago O'Hare International Airport, then crashes into an airline agent, sending both his ticket and a stack of boarding passes fluttering to the floor. Kevin explains that his family is already on the plane and he doesn't want to get left behind. Do you have a boarding pass? The agent asks. Kevin gestures to the pile of paper tickets and is ultimately allowed onto the plane. Today, boarding passes are tied to specific passengers, often stored on smartphones and scanned at the gate to confirm the travelers are on the correct flight. The stricter unaccompanied minor policies and fees of airlines would add yet another layer of protection today, Jacobson said. In the movie, the gate agent walks Kevin down the jet bridge and asks if he spots his family on board. Kevin points to the stranger he's mistaken for his father. The agent waves him on, tells him to grab an empty seat, and that's that. Children flying alone. Unaccompanied minors are closely tracked today. Most carriers require children under a certain age, often 14 or younger, to be formally registered as unaccompanied minors if they aren't traveling with an adult, Jacobson said. That comes with special paperwork and airline staff members who are assigned to escort a child through the airport to their seat on the plane and off the plane at their destination. The Biden administration proposed a rule last year to ban airlines from charging families additional fees to sit together on flights and requiring them to seat children ages 13 and under next to an accompanying adult when adjacent seating is available at booking. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said this month he had no update on the proposal. Even if every current safeguard somehow failed, a passenger on the wrong plane would get noticed quickly, Jacobson said. Flight attendants review passenger counts and special service lists before departure. A 10-year-old boy missing from one flight and an extra child on another would trigger immediate alarms. In other words, the movie magic holds up 33 years after Home Alone 2 Lost in New York came out, but the logistics do not, Jacobson said. We take for granted that we had those freedoms back then that we don't have today, for good reason, he said. We had to give up those freedoms in exchange for other freedoms, like safer air travel. The December holidays can still be a hectic time to travel. This year, 122.4 million Americans were expected to travel at least 50 miles from home between Saturday and New Year's Day, topping last year's record of 119.7 million, according to AAA's holiday forecast. Holiday celebrations look different for everyone, but the common thread is the desire to travel, whether it's returning to your hometown or exploring new destinations, Stacy Barber, Vice President of AAA Travel, said. About 89% of the holiday travelers, or 109.5 million people, are expected to go by car, while more than 8 million are expected to take domestic flights, AAA said. The passenger numbers would be a record for the holiday period, despite domestic round-trip flights costing an average of 7% more compared to last year, according to AAA data. And under local news, three Congress Republicans no pardon for Madigan. Illinois' three Republican members of Congress are urging President Donald Trump not to use his pardon powers to grant clemency to imprisoned former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. Pardoning Madigan, a Southwest Side Democrat who for decades was arguably the state's most powerful politician, would send a dangerous message that public officials can betray the public trust with impunity, U.S. Reps Mike Boast of Murfreesboro, Darren LaHood of Peoria, and Mary Miller of Hinesboro wrote in a two-page letter to Trump. The Tuesday letter from the three, who represent much of downstate Illinois, came a week after the Tribune and other media reported that Madigan had officially asked Trump for clemency following his February conviction on multiple corruption charges. Madigan applied through the Justice Department's Office of the Pardon Attorney for a pardon after completion of sentence, according to records. The application is pending, according to the officer's website. The investigation that led to the former speaker's conviction and the 7.5-year prison sentence revealed that Madigan used his decades of political power to direct contracts, influence state agencies, and manipulate the awarding of government funds for personal gain and the benefit of allies. His actions harmed the people of our state and undermined their trust in the government, the three Republicans wrote. The related convictions of former Commonwealth Edison executives and lobbyists, including Madigan confidant Michael McLean, underscore this was a broad and serious corruption network and that multiple participants were held accountable under the law, they wrote. Granting clemency in this case would not only reward a lifetime of unethical behavior, but also embolden other public officials to exploit their offices for personal gain, the lawmakers concluded. For these reasons, we respectfully urge you to deny any request for a presidential pardon for Michael Madigan. Denying his request is the best way to ensure that Illinois residents know their leaders are held to the highest standards of integrity. Several sources previously told the Tribune that Mike Madigan also sought relief from Trump through the back channels in Washington around the time of his sentencing in June, but the White House took no action. Current and former lawyers for Madigan have said they didn't have a role in crafting this petition, which is not publicly available. Madigan, 83, began serving his sentence in October at a medium security prison in West Virginia. His expected release date is March 2032, not long before his 90th birthday. The White House declined to comment on Madigan's pardon request or the Republican lawmaker's letter, noting that the president is the final decision maker on all pardons and commutations. While Madigan has applied through formal clemency process, Trump has taken an unconventional and surprisingly bipartisan approach to pardons. In February, the president gave a full pardon to former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, a Democrat whose prison sentence for federal corruption convictions Trump commuted during his first term. Boast and LaHood, who were in office in 2018 when Trump freed Blagojevich from prison 8 years into his 14-year sentence, were critical of the president's decision at the time. When Trump pardoned Blagojevich earlier this year, LaHood said in a statement that while he respected the president's pardon powers, it was a mistake to clear the former governor's slate. Former Governor Blagojevich has a clear and documented record of egregious corruption and has been criminally convicted by a jury, LaHood said. The decision harms the faith and trust that citizens have in our justice system. And we need, an appeal of Madigan's conviction is pending before the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. And that's all we have time for in Part 1. Please stay tuned. Part 2 will be returned in just a few moments.